Welcome to the Nerdist Podcast! Hey you guys, hop on over to the Nerdist channel today to see Team Nerdist Bull, Team Walking Dead. Robert Kirkman and the cast of The Walking Dead try to knock down Team Nerdist from their undefeated streak. Will it happen? Well, you could just find out if you went over there. Also, Matt Myra, Jonah Ray, and I will be taking the Nerdist Podcast live to Phoenix, Arizona, May 25th, and in our hometown of Los Angeles, California, at Club Nokia on June 2nd. Information about that is at nerdist.com/calendar. Hey, Stamps.com, you're the nicest company in the world for sponsoring this episode of the Nerdist Podcast. Look, you probably want to start some kind of business. I don't know you, but I'm pinning that on you anyway. Problem is, you already work a job that you hate, so you're going to have to build this other business on the side, which means mailers, which means you're not going to have time to go to the post office. But Stamps.com makes this super easy. You can buy and print official U.S. postage right from your own computer anywhere in the world. It's easy, it's convenient. It automatically calculates the exact postage you need for any letter or package, or you can print directly onto the envelope if you want to. There's labels, or you can print onto plain paper, and then you just hand it to your mail carrier. Hey, here you go, Keith Mail Carrier Ston. When I say you will never have to go to the post office again, I absolutely mean it. Unless you have to pick up a package or something, but that's not our business. Right now, Stamps.com has a special offer for Nerdist listeners. Using the promo code Nerdist, you get a no-risk trial, $110 bonus offer, including a digital scale and $55 of free postage. Holy crap! So please don't wait. Go to Stamps.com before you do anything else. Click on the radio microphone at the top of the homepage and type in Nerdist. That's it! Stamps.com, enter the promo code Nerdist. And now this episode! Okay, it's John Lithgow. So this, there are no words for how amazing this was. Amaze-tast-incredible? I don't know, but if you have the words for what it's like to sit down with one of America's greatest actors right next to a theater and just have an hour-long conversation about stuff, then maybe give them to me, because they're not in my brain. This was also incredibly timed. It just so happened that an hour and a half before we sat down to talk, John found out that he was nominated for a Tony for his work in The Columnist, which you should absolutely go see if you're in New York for the next couple months. But if you ever had any doubts in your mind about whether or not John Lithgow was an incredibly sweet, intelligent, engaging, and warm individual, then all of those doubts will be kicked in the face right here on the Nerdist Podcast, episode number 203, with John Lithgow.
Now entering Nerdist.com.
Yeah.
An anarchist from turn of the century.
With the little wick in it. Right. I don't know. But they were like, yeah, these bowling balls really set the... So anyway, if you're a professional bowler or if you're thinking about bowling, just check your bag.
If your name is Sacco Vanzetti. My God.
I'll leave you guys to it. Do you need anything?
Okay, thanks. I think
we talk for an hour?
Good, yeah.
Wow.
Okay.
Thanks, Mandy.
Okay,
great. First of all, congratulations on your Tony nomination. This happened.
This happened an hour and a half ago. Now, can you believe that we scheduled this for this morning? I could have either come here sort of glowing with triumph or drooping with defeat. And I scheduled it anyway.
You know, it could have been the, how's it going today? Not so great. Not so great.
No, I'm very happy and very proud of our show. So
you've been through this before, though, a few times.
Yeah, this is my sixth Tony nomination.
Wow.
And I guess the last one was for Dirty Rotten Scoundrels.
Right.
And that was like 2005 or so.
Did Frank Oz direct that?
No, that was directed by Jack O'Brien.
Okay.
He directed the movie, right. Yeah.
Yeah.
And we had his blessing.
Oh, that's nice. That's a fantastic. I love that movie.
Yeah, it was a great musical too.
Is this kind of get? Do you still get nervous about it, or do you still just go, this awards thing is just part of it?
Oh no, it's still very exciting. You know, it's very intense when you do theater. All of us who are nominated, or like 60, 70% are all doing our shows.
Mm-hmm.
So you're in the community. You're seeing everybody every night in bars. And there are all sorts of Tony events, yeah, and Drama Desk and Outer Critics Circle events and Drama League events. This is it's kind of the equivalent of Oscar season in Hollywood, I guess. But
sure,
that season all leads up to the Oscars.
Right.
Well, this all leads up to the Tonys, too, except the nominations have all been announced. So now we all get to go to all the parties together. And if you're not nominated, you don't get to go at any parties. So it's pure junior high school.
But, you know? But don't you feel like Oscar season is so, like, tight-assed, and something about, I don't know, just the Tony Awards just have a real nice vibe,
yeah,
to them.
Yeah, well, the New York theater community has a nice vibe. As I say, we're working stiffs. All of us are in the theater district every night,
yeah,
doing our shows. It's kind of exhausting, but it's all a big party.
Yeah.
And work is play.
But you've been, this is, from what I know about you, your entire life has revolved around theater, pretty much.
Yeah, that's been the spine of things. I grew up in a theater family, and that I became an actor against my own wishes, you know.
Yeah.
I didn't really want to go into the family business, but it was my destiny,
yeah,
as of age 20. So, yeah, I mean, it's in my bones. I think what I do on TV and in the movies is bring all my theater equipment with me.
Yeah.
You know, it's I'm a rather theatrical actor no matter what I'm doing.
Do you feel like I know when I work on different kinds of things, they're slightly different muscles. So where is your brain when you're doing television or film or theater? You must kind of adjust for the slice, I guess.
I think you adjust the pitch of things, but it's the same process. You're still playing roles.
Yeah.
And remembering lines, depending on who the director is. Judd Apatow, not necessary to know your lines.
Just have fun?
Yeah. But it's basically you talk louder and you play to the back of the theater when you're on stage, and you play for the camera on film, and you have to know the difference. I had this big breakthrough moment in my life.
You're probably getting a ton of emails at this point.
I thought I had turned this off. I can't be trusted to know when my BlackBerry is off. When I did the Twilight Zone movie for mm-hmm. George Miller,
yes.
George Miller, who directed Road Warrior and Mad Max and all those real high-octane movies, it was about the fifth or sixth movie I'd done, but it was the first one where the director was constantly telling me to do more instead of do less, you know? And if you remember the high energy of that...
You had to fill Shatner's shoes from the old Twilight Zone
Nightmare
show.
Nightmare at 35,000 yeah. feet. And everything I did, he would say, more, more. He would say things like, I want it to look like your face is going to crack, you know?
Yeah.
It was like, boy, have I ever found my director for movies. That was the first time I'd been asked to basically play to the back of the house.
Oh,
it was
wow.
very, very liberating. And before you know it, I was doing Buckaroo Banzai,
oh,
you know?
Gosh, Buckaroo Banzai across the eighth dimension.
Yeah. Now, that was not only a theater performance, that was a, like, Dario Fo performance, just to completely blow out all the gaskets.
What did you do when you saw the script for Buckaroo Banzai? You were like, what? They're what?
And then
and everyone's
right.
John? What?
Yeah, I said no. I turned it down, but then I met Rick Richter and Earl Mac Rauch and just said, and then I said yes.
Yeah.
They're such unbelievably cool guys. Rick said, you know, just do this. I guarantee you'll have fun. And it was I never stopped laughing from that day to the day we wrapped. It was just hilarious fun.
Is that a good rule of thumb for you when you sort of get into a position where you can kind of pick and choose more, where you just go, well, this seems like the most fun thing, rather than this is going to be a blockbuster Hollywood, blah, blah, blah.
You know, there's always about 10 reasons to turn down or take a movie or a play. But the most important is exactly that. Just what does your gut tell you and what is going to be the most exciting and fun and who the people are you're going to be working with.
Yeah.
I think that's the most important. Life is too short to work for assholes. You know? Sometimes you just have to.
Have you ever been on something and you're like, this guy turned out to not be awesome?
Yes. And I'm not going
to. You don't have to say. You don't have to say what it is. Well, what do you do with that situation? Do you just sort of go inward and go, well, just a way to get through this?
Well, you find all sorts of ways to make it fun for yourself and to try to do good work. I don't mean to sound like a snob, but everybody knows the feeling of working for an asshole.
Sure.
You can't avoid it.
But it's hard when the director is the person that you're supposed to trust the most.
Yeah.
Right? And if your relationship to that person is uncomfortable, how do you get around that and still give the performance that you need to?
I don't know. You just find ways. You just, a lot of times you have to do your own work. You know, it's interesting. There's a difference between movie acting and the whole process of movies and plays are very different, and television is its own variation. The great skill of a theater director tends to be working with actors, directing scenes, finding the moments when a scene turns, you know, really analyzing, giving you notes on lines, timing. A movie director has a lot more things to think about than that. You often have to do that work for yourself. Some directors are, you know, there's so many different areas in which a director has to function. And you can almost have a bar graph of the various, very good at camera, sure, very good at casting, very good at script, very good at storytelling, or not.
Yeah.
I remember discussing this with George Roy Hill, a great old-timer, fantastic director of The Sting, Butch Cassidy, and The World According to Garp.
Of course.
I was telling him my theory about the different areas in which a director has to function. He said, no. A director has to only think about three things: the script, the casting, the execution. That's it.
Wow.
You know, and he's right.
Well, that movie was, you know, I saw that movie when I was young, and I went into it going, oh, Robin Williams.
Oh, wow.
This is going to be an hilarious.
What did you think? How old were you, and what did you think?
What was Garp, like 83?
83, I think. Yeah.
Okay, so I was 12. Oh, and God.
What did you think, make of Roberto Muldoon?
I remember being horrified by the guy getting his dick bitten off in the back of the car.
Yeah, everyone was.
But other than that, I remember it was the first time, because I come from a comedy background. Like, I was just a huge comedy fanatic. And it was the first time I started to realize, oh, comedians are not just comedians. Mm-hmm. They can do serious roles, and they can, you know, they can take on heavier stuff. But I remember being confused in the first part of it, like, why is he?
When is he going to be funny?
Where's Mork? You know, like, I was just a stupid, you know, kid. Well,
and the most frequent direction that the Marine George Roy Hill gave to Robin Williams was, now, don't give me any of that comedy shit. Talk about execution.
But the Roberta character was sort of the, I mean, if there was to be some sort of a relief in the story, I mean, besides sort of being a support structure for his character, was definitely a relief. And the way that you played, you know, just, you know, you're a big, tall guy.
Yeah.
You know, and you the linebacker, but the wig and the super, super straight, but hilarious.
Yeah. Yeah, it was fascinating. I played that part as kind of as inconspicuously as I could, very much as myself, you know, just being a very kind of soft version of myself, and let just the fact of my size and physicality and wig and costuming and prosthetic breasts take care of the comedy. You know, it was just, and the fascinating thing was, my first couple of scenes had big laughs. My third scene, I burst into tears because I couldn't have children.
Mm-hmm.
It's very tender and sad, melancholy moment. It was a wonderful part of many colors.
Yeah.
Interestingly enough, I Marion Daugherty, the great casting director, presented me to George Roy Hill as her first choice to play Roberta Muldoon at the beginning of his casting period, and he absolutely ruled it out. He said, no, turn me down, because he thought I was too tall. Put me next to Robin Williams and it would just be too ridiculous. But he spent 8 months trying to cast the part. He finally came back to me, and I did a screen test with three other actors, and bam, there was Roberta. It took him that long to finally realize that what I just said, just the bizarre visual, takes care of a whole world of challenges in filming that role.
It's nice. You usually kind of want to come in at the end of the casting process rather than the beginning.
I was her very first choice. This was a great lady, one of the greats in our business who just passed away, Marion Daugherty.
Yeah.
She almost invented the whole concept of casting director.
Really?
Yeah. Or I think she is the person who got casting directors opening credits on a film, you know, or major credits.
There's a real, I think just living in Los Angeles and being in the business for a long time, you sort of take the job of casting director for granted. You're like, oh, you see casting directors all day. And a lot of them just sort of fell into it.
Yeah.
But it really, like when you find one that really has, you know, vision, it really does make a huge, really does make a huge difference.
And you think of the great shows, TV shows, for example. The casting is absolutely everything. And the casting people are very much involved with the process early on.
Yeah.
Casting Third Rock from the Sun was so much fun and took like 2 months. You know, like daily sessions with people, getting just the right people. And look what we ended up with.
Yeah. When you were auditioning, do you go in with a pretty solid idea, or do you go in with sort of an idea but open to be flexible if they start telling you to play around with it?
Well, those were the old days. I haven't auditioned in a long time.
Of course.
But that was always my... Early on, I think an actor tries to be extremely prepared and tends to be very anxious and scared to death of auditions. And then when you become more and more of a veteran, you realize the more you can relax, the more you can present yourself as somebody who doesn't particularly need the job, the more they desperately want you.
Yes.
And yes, indeed, present yourself as, I'll do whatever you want me to do. Give me some ideas and let me show you what I can do with them. The most recent session I had that even resembles a casting session was with Judd Apatow. He was in preparation for this film, This is 40,
yeah,
which we shot last August, and it'll be out next winter. And my agent arranged for me to meet with Judd, because we'd met each other, but we didn't really know each other, and he was very forthright. We had a wonderful session. He said, the reason we're meeting is I can't really write characters until I know who's playing the part. And this part is just so unformed in my mind. And we just had a long, long conversation with Leslie Mann there, Judd's wife, and the one who would be playing my daughter if I was cast in the part. We just talked. He talked a lot about his own history. He told me the whole story of the movie. Leslie talked about her history. I found myself telling about my various family issues. And he kept referring to the fact that to the extent that he'd worked on the part at all, it had derived from improvs with other actors. He even threw out the names of some of the actors he'd worked with on the part. And at a certain point I said, well, geez, why don't we do some improvising? And he was so relieved because he had felt that was against the rules, like my agent had instructed him, no auditioning. This is just a media.
Right.
And we improvised for about 20 minutes. And when I saw the next draft of the script, like half my role came right out of those improvs.
Do you like improv?
This was a fantastic experience and a very new experience working with Judd. I've always improved as a little tool to finding the essence of a scene. usually with the writers around. Like Third Rock, there was a tremendous amount of improv in the rehearsal process.
Sure.
But always with the writers there. And by the time we performed it, it was always a very tight script.
Mm-hmm.
But it was just a great... It's like when you're talking about, well, wait, what's the problem with this scene? Well, what's going on here is this and that. Before you know it, you're basically improvising the scene, finding the truth of it, and then they go off and write it.
Mm-hmm.
Judd works the other way. There was a script for This Is 40, but as you film any given scene, you know, he sets up three cameras that, with this new technology, they'll run for 20 minutes. And you play the scripted scene. He's about 10 feet away behind a black cloth yelling different lines to try or telling you to do that line again this way. The cameras keep rolling. Nobody says cut. And you're fully expected at a certain point to simply start improvising the scene. And you do it again. He'll hear something he likes. He has a writer next to him who'll scribble ideas and pass them to him, and he'll yell that. And, you know, you film 20 minutes of material on a scene that will only end up 50 seconds long.
Mm-hmm.
And then from all that, it's like winnowing wheat. He gets just fabulous stuff that is so just completely spontaneous and real. It's a wonderful process. I imagine it's kind of the Larry David process, too.
Sure.
I've never worked on Curb Your Enthusiasm, but it's... I guess it is a kind of new mode, and Apatow has a lot to do with creating that mode.
Yeah, I think a lot of people do that now where they they sort of realize, like, oh, you know, if you just sort of keep the ball in the air, but you let people be funny and natural, yeah. You don't, it's a lot better than, like, all right, you have to say my words exactly the way I wrote them, because that doesn't always work.
And he had so many examples of, like, incredible moments that you would remember from Knocked Up or whatever. That just burst out of improvisation, took everybody by surprise. And they have this, you know, it's a kind of Apatow style that you can recognize. You know, it's, movies are interesting that way, and that is another big distinction from plays. Plays, you're polishing a gemstone every night, you're refining it and getting it better and better so that you absolutely can count on a performance. And you can count on your other actors to know exactly how a moment is to be played. Movies, you're capturing accidents at the best of times. And it's a different discipline. Of course, Judd's gang, Paul Rudd and Leslie Mann and Jason Segel, they're all, Chris O'Dowd, they're all in This Is 40. Albert Brooks, absolute master of this. They are so good at this particular technique. It was like joining... at the top of the food chain for me. I just loved it.
When you're doing a play, so The Columnist, this play, you've been nominated, you know, you've been doing the play's been open for almost a month now.
Mm-hmm.
Do you ever feel when you're doing a play that it's done, or do you constantly make adjustments throughout the entire run of a production?
Well, you make adjustments, but I think a person seeing... If the person saw the show the first week and then saw it again 10 months later, he would see he wouldn't even see the differences. The actors might see that certain moments had grown or changed. The script is no longer rewritten after an opening night on a new play. It's kind of your job to make it appear completely new to the audience. On this subject, I always tell this wonderful story about, from classical music, about like Sir Thomas Beecham guest conducting the Pittsburgh Symphony in Brahms' second and rehearsing during the day when the concert is that night and getting no interest or enthusiasm or energy from the orchestra and stopping and saying, "Ladies and gentlemen, I know you are bored to death by Brahms' second. You've played it 1,000 times and you have no particular interest in playing it again tonight. But there are two people in the audience tonight that I want you to play this for. The person who's hearing Brahms' second for the first time and the person who's hearing it for the last time."
Oh, wow.
And that's kind of my philosophy of theater acting. It's not supposed to be exciting for us. It's supposed to be exciting for them. it's not going to be new for us, but it is new for them. And at the very heart of it is, you're giving them something. You're giving them a gift, the gift of an emotional experience. And that's our job. And it's our job to do it really, really well so that they feel it's brand new. There's a fantastic show that's just opened, which you should see while you're here if you can.
Okay.
Called One Man, Two Governors. You ever heard of it?
No.
It's from the National Theatre. It's been a huge hit in London for a year. It's an update to the early 60s of a Carlo Goldoni Commedia dell'arte comedy,
okay.
Servant of Two Masters. And a brilliant actor also nominated my competition for Tony this morning, James Corden.
All right.
It's like the good old-time British music hall farce, like vaudeville, British vaudeville. Cross purposes, mistaken identities, servant of two masters. You know, it's his job to serve two masters without them knowing that there's only one of him. It's ridiculous, completely ridiculous. But they've built into the show all these moments where anything can happen. Bits with of audience interaction where it's side-splittingly funny because people come up from the audience. You know, he basically ambushes them and yanks them up on the audience, on stage, which is very, very funny. The extraordinary thing is there are also moments that they've calculated to look like something is happening. You know, it's very carefully planned to look like it's totally unplanned.
Sure.
And it is brilliant the way they've done it. In fact, I'm probably giving away a very important secret by even saying this in public.
Spoiler alert. Minor spoiler alert.
But it doesn't spoil anything. It's such a wonderful show.
I was always afraid of kind of theater. I'm a stand-up and
I'm afraid of stand-up.
Really?
Are you kidding me?
Oh, but it's but you can make left and right turns if you need to, but with theater, you know, with a play, you're locked into it and you have to figure out where the moments are without adding words, and you have to keep finding gems with what you've already been working with, and that scares the shit out of me.
I can't. It's very interesting because I find comedy to be performing without a net and hair-raisingly scary. I have such an admiration for the great stand-ups for that reason. Just the extraordinary quicksilver minds.
Yeah. Who did you like, stand-up-wise?
Well, I saw Steve Martin about 3 months before his first appearance on SNL.
Oh, wow. Like right before everything blew
right
up.
Right before, when he was absolutely brilliant and nobody knew who he was.
Was
at the Troubadour.
At the Troubadour.
Not the Troubadour, the boarding house.
The boarding house in San Francisco.
Yeah. Did you read his great book?
Of course. I listened to the audiobook because he reads it.
Fantastic. Fantastic piece of writing about the comedy process. And I still, in my entire life, and I'm 66 years old, I've never laughed so hard at anything live.
Was the whole audience into it? Because he sort of tells it like, well, in the early days, a handful of people would be into it, and the rest of the people would be puzzled.
By this time, he had a cult following in San Francisco. As I said, 3 months later, he was on SNL. He was discovered as the wild and crazy guy with the banjo and the arrow in his head and the Groucho nose. I literally pissed myself laughing. It was unbelievably funny. He's become a very good friend, and I've told him that.
How did he take it? He's shy, right?
He's very shy. It's like all business with him.
Right. I know now, I think because he was the reason that I ever even wanted to get into stand-up. My parents gave me Steve Martin albums when I was growing up. And you know, when I started this podcast a couple years ago, like, he was one of the guys that I was like, oh, I got to get Steve Martin on. And as time went on, I realized, like, I don't know if I'd be able to...
Have you had him on?
No, because first of all, I'd be happy to talk about bluegrass if that's all he wants to talk about.
Yeah.
But I know that he just, I don't know, I feel like he said everything in the book.
Yeah.
And there wouldn't, if I
said, I mean, he's done us a huge favor by writing that book because he really did remake comedy, but he's not ever going to be the one to talk about it in those terms.
Right.
And he does in the book. You know, he talks about this discovery of a new kind of irony. And it really is, it is amazing. I mean, the fact that he was there at the beginning of SNL is no coincidence.
Right.
A remarkable man.
Well, I really hope that he does. He must have a sense that he completely changed and influenced a generation of comedians and mm-hmm. comedy itself.
I don't know. It's he would probably deflect a compliment like that. Why don't I pretend to be Steve Martin? We'll improvise interview. No,
sure.
No.
Steve, when you invented the new comedy...
All I need to do is fall silent.
Steve, I'm going to get an inch from your face and start asking you about stand-up. Does that make you uncomfortable? Oh, my God, you're so brilliant. Oh, my God, Steve, you're
still
so brilliant.
He's still brilliant. I mean, his talk show appearances nowadays, which he calculates very carefully. He works very hard on.
Sure.
He's a great craftsman.
Yeah.
Which is the other thing that that book reveals. How much carpentry goes into all this. Stand-ups fascinate me. The way they... It's like some people go to gyms, they go to improv. They go to comedy clubs mm-hmm. to try out new material.
Yeah.
Just amazing. And you see the great ones like Eddie Izzard or... Billy Connolly.
Oh, yeah.
You see Billy in a small space, and you feel like you were there watching Michelangelo work on that ceiling, you know?
Yeah.
Well, just great.
Comedy's a really hard thing to capture on tape, film, or, and you still get the energy of Billy Connolly just listening to him. Mm-hmm. I've never gotten to see him live, but I imagine it's just like a friggin' tidal wave.
You know, he did this... A couple of years ago, he did a couple of weeks in Chelsea in a small room, and he did a couple of weeks at the Brentwood Theater on the VA campus mm-hmm. in Westwood.
Yeah.
The Brentwood Theater, which you can't even find with a map.
Well, that compound. Every building looks the same.
You cannot find it. It takes you about a half an hour to find it, and you find it. And Billy Connolly is there, and so is Nicole Kidman and Eddie Izzard. You know, they've all made this pilgrimage. An audience of about 200 people. And it was one of the great nights of comedy I've ever seen.
Oh, man. Well, Billy's wife was my therapist for a while.
Wow.
And so it made me afraid to... ask if I could ever go see him because I didn't want to. You know what I mean?
Because it's time to fire your therapist.
He's not anymore, but just at the time, it was just.
You've never seen him live?
No, I've never seen him.
Have you ever met him?
Yes. Oh. I worked with him once, and he was awesome.
Oh, he did. The first time I met him, he did a guest thing on Third Rock from the Sun.
Yeah.
And God, we just loved each other. We had a supper between. Like the last camera rehearsal and the performance every week on Third Rock. And I sat across from Billy the way, you know, I were eating supper. And he had me laughing so hard that I had to tell him to stop. You know, like carrots were going up into my nose. I had to perform. It was like, stop, don't say nothing, Billy. I said, no, don't say not another word. No, but no, just please, just quiet. You have to just stop talking. He's just crazy funny.
And he's also part of the Steve Martin, like, banjo cadre.
Yeah.
Where these,
what's that about?
The comedians and banjos.
Kevin Nealon plays.
Kevin Nealon, yeah. He's part of that,
that's
too.
That's right. I once... I learned bluegrass banjo in the 80s and never got, on a scale of 1 to 10, I got to about 1.5. It's a very hard instrument, really. But I did a Discover commercial in the 90s, where the whole deal was they give you a Discover card and you're supposed to use it for a month. Mm-hmm. And then they look at what you spent. What you paid for with a Discover card, and they based the entire commercial on what it is you did, these various celebrities, me and Michael Chang and a couple of other people. Michael Chang bought tennis balls.
Sure.
So they featured tennis balls. I, among very many other things, I paid for my banjo lessons. And they said, oh, banjo. So by this time, I had paid for my son's guitar lessons, but I mentioned the fact that I used to take banjo lessons, and they seized on that. So I got my banjo teacher, and I sort of brushed up a couple of licks, and I played the banjo, among many, many other things, on this little commercial.
Yeah.
Well, of course, I did okay, but it was pretty lame. They overdubbed, like, Bella Fleck or something. So ever since, everybody thinks I'm this great banjo player. I have this recurring nightmare of appearing on the Leno show and having somebody put a banjo in my lap.
You're a banjo player, and you take this banjo. No, please, get it away. And you just start running.
Yeah.
See, Michael Chang took the easy choice, the safe choice. He bought tennis balls. Way to go out on a limb, Michael Chang. Other people are buying banjos. I saw you. It's always been enjoyable to watch you on stuff, just even as yourself, because you do seem to have fun. Mm-hmm. And I think it might have been. It was either a Golden Globe or an Emmy. You won an award for Third Rock, and your accepted speech was like, all I do is go, what? It's just a complete, like, totally self-deprecating, like, I'm winning an award for this? And it just was like, oh, it's nice to see someone have fun with it and not...
Well, boy, Third Rock was nonstop fun. But it is true. As I recall it, earlier in the evening, they had put up a clip from Third Rock of me. The whole joke was Sally had been asked to appear nude in Playboy magazine. Mm-hmm. And I said, what? Your naked body photographed on a full, double fold-out spread, pinned to the inside of every horny young pubescent teenager's locker in every high school across the country. Good for you. And later that evening, I won the award. And I said, honestly, I don't know why I won this. Everybody in Hollywood thinks what I do on Third Rock is completely disgraceful. I mean, you saw it up there tonight. Good for you! I said, I'm embarrassed myself. But I will tell you, I loved Third Rock and I was so proud of it. And my here's a guilty admission. I still watch reruns of it. It's on TV now on The Reels channel.
Oh, that's nice.
And I tape it. I watch it late. I watched an episode last night.
That's nice, though. It's like having a slideshow of a fun period of your life.
Well, it was now a dozen years ago. I've forgotten all these episodes. And they are fabulous. I mean, that was a great show. When it was good, it was really, really good.
Yeah, that was one of those shows. Usually sitcoms take a season or two to find their footing. And I remember... That was a show that came pretty hard out of the gate.
Yeah.
Where people were like, oh, shit, you got to watch this. You got to watch this Third Rock show. And you guys seem to have the voice of the show pretty quickly.
Yeah. Well, so much of that came from, I guess, the synergy between me and Bonnie and Terry and the rest of the cast. Jane Curtin, for sure.
Yeah.
And this incredible cast. That's the 2 months we were talking about. Putting them all together and finding French Stewart and Joey Gordon-Levitt. Now big movie
star.
He's doing all right. I'm waiting for him to hire me.
Yeah, what the hell, Joseph Gordon-Levitt? I still can't say, I still can't hear Jane Curtin's name without wanting to go, Jane Curtin! Like,
yes.
Even though that hasn't happened for three decades.
I know. I worked with Danny Aykroyd recently,
the way,
on this incredible Jay Roach comedy that's coming this summer.
Yeah.
Called The Campaign. That's the new name for it.
Oh, is Zach Galifianakis in there too?
Yeah, Will Ferrell.
Mm-hmm.
Will and Zach play equally idiotic candidates for a backwater congressional seat in North Carolina. And Danny and I play billionaire brothers who finance Zach, you know, for our right-wing agenda. And boy, it was so much fun working with Danny. We had actually done the little epilogue to the Twilight Zone movie together.
You want to see something really scary.
Exactly.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Although I was lying on a gurney and he was driving the ambulance. We literally never looked at each other during the whole scene, and I think maybe exchanged two or three sentences of conversation. That was the extent of our friendship. But boy, are we pals now.
Oh, you know, that's nice.
Wonderful, wonderful time on that movie.
That's great. When does that come out?
August 10th, I think, okay. In the middle of the presidential campaign.
Oh,
and
good
boy, do
timing.
We ever have its number. It's great.
How do you, you know, I always think actors have this sort of weird curse where you're blessed or cursed, however you want to look at it, with this kind of hyper-awareness, you know? I think a lot of performing types suffer from anxiety. There's a lot of depression, I think. But just hyper aware. But your job requires you to get out of your, to get your brain out of the way, right? Because mm-hmm. you can't really be aware when you're acting. Is that fair to say?
Well, I think that's a great blessing, though. I mean, it takes you out of yourself. You know, I've been through some hard times in my life now and then, and work was always my great salvation. It is a joy. I mean, we don't work, we play.
Yeah.
We play. That's the verb for acting, is to play parts. And it sure beats working for a living. You know, I mean, yes, we are neurotic people, I think, actors. I mean, all of us are neurotic people.
Sure.
That's a given. But actors have this curious way of sort of running from reality, running from harsh reality, or making reality tolerable, not just for themselves, but for other people. As I say, that's our job.
Mm-hmm.
Why else do people go to theaters, huddle in the dark with a bunch of strangers and watch people up on stage, lit up with artificial light? There's something that drives them to go there. We're all part of the same process. We're all stepping out of reality for a while. And we're all having a good time doing it when it's good.
Yeah.
Actors are just part one half of that transaction. I'm sounding extremely pretentious.
Not at all, actually. No. It's just something that interests me from the standpoint of, I feel like there's, especially with comedy, you can watch a lot of comedy and you go, that guy, he knows he's playing a funny part. As opposed mm-hmm. to someone who just is.
Yeah.
And I'm always trying to figure out, as someone who has difficulty getting out of my own way sometimes, like, mm-hmm. how to achieve that sense of, you know, at least perceived non-awareness.
Yeah. Well, I mean, the question that I always ask of myself, and I'm fascinated by the answers I get from other people, is why do you do this? What was the first... your first impulse to do it? And I think it's an unanswerable question. I can't quite get my brain around it. It is a certain kind of thrill that I seek out and can't do without. But what is it? It's a strange thing I do, acting out stories for other people. I'm not sure why they need it and what they're getting out of it, especially when you're doing drama in which your highest achievement is making people cry.
Mm-hmm.
You know, when you hear people sniffle and sob out of the audience, you think, yes! Well, what kind of weird torture is that? You know, breaking people's hearts.
It could just be an emotional exercise, like going to the gym. You need to feel the depths of your emotions to keep sane,
yeah.
Maybe?
Well, emotional exercise is exactly the phrase I use for it in my... I've written a memoir last year. You know, and there was a whole chapter where I kind of ruminated on these various issues, and that's what I came up with. We all need emotional exercise. It just heightens our sense of ourselves as feeling people.
Right.
And I don't know, we sort of ossify unless we get that
sure.
exercise. And we all absolutely require it, whether it's going to the paying $100 to go see a Broadway play or seeing a movie or watching CSI on television
right.
or listening to a country music song. I mean, there are various sources for this, but absolutely everybody has to have it in every culture, you know. In Mongolia, they're doing something to amuse themselves.
You know? It's probably the internet now. That's what everyone does. <That's> right. Yeah, but you're either growing or you're dead. You die. You know, like you have to go in some direction.
And emotional exercise is about the best phrase I can come up with, and you used it yourself.
Hey! did you, you know, when you hit 40, 50, 60, was that helpful for you? You know, did you enjoy the sort of like, I've gained 10 more years wisdom and I see, you know, was there any part that was like, boy, you know, getting older is weird? Or were you like, no, I'm embracing it. I love it. And it's just helped me be a better person.
I don't know. If you're wise, an actor embraces his age and plays parts that are age appropriate and doesn't worry about growing old. In fact, thinks of it as opening up a whole new range of roles. Uh-huh. This part I'm playing right now, Joseph Alsop in The Columnist, is he ages between mid-40s and late 50s. An incredible part, full of all kinds of issues of old age, you know, very, very painful issues of growing older and losing your relevancy, uh-huh, as a journalist in his case. Losing your sense of yourself and your sense of your power. These are issues that you confront when you're north of 60. So I've got these roles are now piling in. I've survived. And I don't have a lot of competition, you know. Anyone with any brains has quit acting long ago. So there's only about five of us left.
Who fucking wants to sit around and do nothing? Who wants to do that?
Well, I mean, the business also chews you up and spits you out.
Yeah.
I mean, it's, I feel as successful as an actor now as I've ever been, and that's a wonderful feeling. I mean, granted, you're interviewing me in the morning. I've been nominated for Tony Award.
It's a pretty good morning so far. Could have gone much differently.
Yes.
I don't know why I still do this.
You would have had very different answers. I mean, that's the other thing. I mean, we are ridiculously vulnerable to people's bad opinion of our work. Absurd. I mean, fortunately, I'm married to a very hard-headed woman who's basically tells me to snap out of it when I fall into a deep sulk. But sure, we're vulnerable to that.
Yeah.
You know, bad reviews are just torture, especially in theater, where you have to go out the next night and perform for people whom you simply assume have read every word with a magnifying glass,
right,
and memorized them.
I'm just coming to make sure this guy sucks like it said when
yes,
I read that
exactly.
thing.
Exactly. It's either, well, he's not that bad, or, yeah, I see what he means. You know, it's just awful.
You just hear, they were right. And then like, you just hear footsteps, knocking the door right. slam. Go.
Or seeing a whole bunch of empty seats. People who just decided not to show up.
Yeah. But that's definitely not happening. Yeah. The Alsop story is pretty interesting, and I don't know all of it. But just for people who don't know, just the idea that he was this political columnist, mm-hmm, who became very powerful, but then also was, you know, a closeted gay man in, mm-hmm, a time period where that was really not okay.
Yeah.
And so, I mean, I don't know. I just, that to look at that story, that you must just start drooling as an actor, like, dang, I need
it. Yeah. I read the script and just, it wasn't even offered to me. I sort of got hold of it, knowing that they were about to put this production together. And I told my agent, you do your bit, I'll do mine. And I emailed the director, who was a friend of mine. And I said, hire me for this. You're not going to find anybody better. I was desperate to play it. Mm-hmm. It's a fantastic role, beautifully written. David Auburn is the playwright, the man who wrote Proof. And, yes, a man with such complicated issues in his life, an extravagantly buoyant, sort of bon vivant, a sort of camp character, just drunk on politics, but also a social butterfly. He loved Georgetown throwing Georgetown parties, in which he would put Robert McNamara and Dean Rusk and, you know, every major political figure together and just watch them argue or lead the arguments. And yet he had this incredible secret in his life. Very camp in an era where camp behavior was a kind of protective coloration.
Sure.
It was kind of a camouflage for your big secret. And he also had... It's a six-character play, which means he has five fascinating relationships with various degrees of awareness of these secret issues in his life. His brother, Stuart, who co-wrote with him, a very combative relationship with his brother. His wife, Susan Mary Alsop, who was a kind of... a picture window wife. His stepdaughter, who in this fictionalized version of his life he's very, very close to, played by Grace Gummer in our production, just wonderful young actress with a very famous mother. And David Halberstam, the very young David Halberstam, who represents young journalism as opposed to also sort of rock-ribbed, conservative, old-time journalism. All these things. So the issues of journalism and sexuality and politics, the Vietnam War, youth and age, all these things are elements in the play and just woven together beautifully. Anyway, that's my advertisement for The Columnist.
Well, I remember when I heard about the play and I just sort of heard the quick log line of... oh, you know, he was a really powerful journalist who could make or break people. I was like, oh, that kind of sounds like Sweet Smell of Success. And I looked up like, oh, you played you played Hunsucker in Sweet Smell of Success.
Yeah. No, wait, actually, this is my fourth big-time journalist. But, you know, there's a reason for that. They are highly theatrical characters.
And also, you got a little of the Harvard blood in you. So
yeah, that's right.
There's a little bit of
also
that going on.
Also, very much a Northeastern kind of Connecticut Yankee who went to Harvard.
Yeah.
It's another reason why I told Dan Sullivan to hire me.
And we both went to Harvard.
Yes.
John, you got the job. Wait, John, let me go. You're hurting me. So,
well,
sorry.
In fact, he took some persuading. He thought I was too old for it.
Really?
Yeah.
How do you talk yourself out of that? How do you talk him out of that?
I said, I can do young. I recently saw a very charming interview with Christopher Plummer, who insisted that he could still play 60.
Oh, that's adorable. I bet he could.
Yeah, there's a great actor.
Let me also say that your season of Dexter was fantastic. I mean, just fantastic. I had sort of, you know, the previous season, I loved the first season. I had fallen off one of the previous seasons, and I heard you were going to be on. I'm like, ah, shit, I gotta check this out. Your character was so fucked up.
Yes.
It was such a cool role, such a cool counterbalance to Dexter Morgan.
Mm-hmm.
How did you, they must have approached you.
Yeah, I mean, it was very interesting. Quite late in the game, I got the offer. Everything happened so fast on television. And it was presented to me in a pitch. Clyde Phillips, the executive producer, head writer on the show, and John Goldwyn, the executive producer. I sat there in a room at CAA, and they told my agents they had to leave. This is wonderful. Culture of secrecy around Dexter. And they told me the entire 12-episode arc, blow by blow, as if it were a campfire story. And they had me so on the edge of my seat. They were giving me information that nobody else had, including the rest of the cast. Michael C. Hall, by that time, was an executive producer, so he could have known this information, but he didn't want to. You know,
oh, right.
He didn't want to know things that the rest of the cast didn't know. So when I took the part and started working on it, I knew things that they didn't know. I mean, spoiler alert, I knew about the secret, I don't think I'll even say.
Okay, you knew a thing.
I knew all sorts of things, and if you remember that 12-episode season, there were about four or five gigantic revelations.
Huge.
And I knew them all. Because they had tried to sell me on the role by just building the suspense as the 12 episodes went on. And the last three or four scripts were not written yet. They were just blocked out. So when I started performing the first several episodes, they took off from that. I mean, they made the character richer and richer or darker and darker. But, you know, those people who know that season, they will remember the lines, "Hi, Dad."
Yes, yes,
and,
yes.
And "Hello, Dexter Morgan." You know, all these these astonishing moments that were, you know, you wait forever to be in something where you make people gasp with surprise, you know.
Yeah.
You pay off suspense that big time.
It would have been a great place to drop in when Dexter says, like, "I see your monster," or whatever. You go, "Good for you." You totally could have dropped that in.
Yes,
you totally could have.
Right.
You totally could have dropped that in. And then we were like, "Oh, that character's really crazy."
Well, you know, that it was great to go into the last big thing I'd done on television, of course, was Third Rock,
sort
of zany, clueless and innocuous character. To be, I mean, to sort of bring that sort of racial imprint into the role of the Trinity Killer was fabulous, because they, it was like a top. You didn't know where it was going to spin, you know. This character could go anywhere, and they plotted it so beautifully that in the first five episodes you barely saw him.
Yeah,
it was a very small part for the first several. You just got little glimpses. Those glimpses were completely hair-raising, but just little, you didn't know what in the world made this man tick. And as they were trying to figure him out, so was the audience. Of course, I knew.
Is it more fun to play a character who is, well, I mean, a character like that doesn't really, probably doesn't see himself as evil, but is it more fun to play like a really messed up evil character or just a happy guy?
Well, it all, you just want it. I mean, I had just as much fun doing Third Rock as I did doing Dexter, and nothing could have been more different. You know, you just look for fascinating dualities, really.
Mm-hmm.
In the case of Dexter, the duality, I think, was this was a pathological killer who was tortured and tormented and hated doing what he was doing. He wanted somebody to stop him. It was a compulsion that he wishes he didn't have. And I just thought that was a fascinating duality. When he was beating somebody to death with his hammer, tears were streaming down his cheeks.
Yeah.
And I thought, that's something that is so disturbing and compelling. And that's all you're interested in, is having that kind of impact on people.
Yeah. Is it? I also know you wrote a bunch of children's books,
mm-hmm,
and recorded some songs. So it's just kind of, it's just like having the different facets of the same person. Are like, honey, look, your favorite author's on.
Right.
Shield your eyes.
That's what I always say to parents. Don't tell the kids about Dexter.
You know, his character John likes singing these songs. It's not. It's pretend.
I know.
It's just pretend.
Well, fortunately, kids have no sense of different realities, you know, or they have no sense of overlapping realities.
Sure.
You know, I'm always getting parents with their little children coming up and saying, "This is the man who plays Lord Farquaad in Shrek." And they just look at me, you know, the 6'4" man with this blank expression.
Yeah.
Let me tell you my favorite story.
Yes.
On exactly this. This line, you remember the opening credits of The World According to Garp? Incredibly memorable. The baby, mm-hmm, flying up in the air,
yeah,
in slow motion to this tune, "When I'm 64.
Yeah.
Well, about 5 or 6 years after Garp came out, I was doing a movie up in Scarsdale, of all places. I took my own kids to the Scarsdale public swimming pool. And a mom and dad with their, like, 5-year-old boy came up to me and said, "Are you the man who was in World According to Garp?" I said, "Yes." "This is, you're not going to believe the coincidence. This is our son, Brandon. he was the little baby in the opening credits. And I said, this is amazing. Yeah, what a coincidence, Brandon, great. And they turned to him and said, Brandon, this man was in your movie.
Hey, tell him I'll take a meeting, man.
And there again, blank expression. Like, so humiliated because his little dick was on full view, if you recall.
Yeah, hopefully it had grown by then. Hopefully it got bigger.
I worked on some animated shows, and they would always think it was a good idea to bring kid tour groups in. Mm-hmm. And then within 5 seconds, the kids are like, what?
Yeah.
They're not paying attention. Right. It's like, you're just a bunch of grown-ups.
Very tricky business entertaining children.
Oh, yeah.
And I do it. I still do it. I still give concerts with orchestras and bands.
Boy, and they literally don't have the ability to hide when they're not interested.
Yeah. I mean, it's...
They don't have decency.
Right. And I've gotten so good at keeping them completely engaged for hour-long concerts. It's really fun.
What's the key with them?
Well, it's very, very basic. It's, I think I take it from my own experience with my own children. When I entertain them, I have a big easel, for one thing. I have these different devices. And a lot of my songs are about animals. Mm-hmm. And I play a game with them called Guess the Animal. I said, I'm going to start drawing an animal, and you have to guess what it is before it's finished. And I draw a huge hippopotamus or whatever, and they start yelling, you know, it's a goat, it's a cow, you know, and then suddenly, it's a hippo, and like 1,000 children are screaming, it's a hippo, and I turn, I say, it's a what, it's a what? And I just drive them into a frenzy, and then finally say, right, it's a hippo, good for you. And then I sing the hippopotamus song, and they listen. You know, that's just one of, I mean, they don't have the slightest clue that I'm doing a number on them, but they love it, and they feel so in control of the experience.
Yeah.
By the same token, when I sing my first song, I come out in a top hat or a derby hat or something. I sing the song before I've even introduced myself. I finish the song, and I start chatting with them, and I have the conductor sort of pull on my sleeve and point to my hat, and I say, what? I reach up, and I feel the hat, and I say, oh, no, I've done it again. I do this all the time. I put the hat on. I sing the song. I forget to take my hat off. It's my worst habit. If it happens again, be sure to tell me. And then, of course, I wear, in the course of the concert, I wear about 6 different hats, progressively ridiculous hats, you know, beanies with propellers or kangaroo ears or a pith helmet. And every time I forget to take the hat off, and once again, they scream as if it's the most important thing in the world. Take off your hat! They have absolutely no sense of irony or deception. And in its curious way, it is the little child version of what I try to do for adults. Suspend disbelief. Make them forget that I'm pretending. Make them completely forget. And children really do. Adults don't entirely forget. They know they're in a theater. But sure, kids simply forget.
You know, you could make so much money. You've basically just described the internet. No sense of irony. They want to be engaged. You could make millions of dollars teaching companies how to brand entertainment for the internet.
Funny, I never thought of that.
If you can control the children, you control the internet. There is a multi-million dollar business for you, John. We're kind of at the end of our hour, and I don't want to take too much of your time, but I want to ask one more thing, which is, I read that, is it true that you were the voice of Yoda in a series of Star Wars radio plays?
It's absolutely true.
Really?
Yeah. Yeah, Lucas produced a radio series after Star Wars and Empire Strikes Back came out. I was working in a play on Broadway, directed by John Madden, the film director who did Shakespeare in Love. And,
so not the football guy.
Not the football guy. Okay. That was the other John Madden.
Okay, he did not go direct theater then.
Yes.
Okay, just making sure.
And Madden was directing radio, too. I mean, he was not a film director yet. And he was directing the Star Wars series, and he said, we're having trouble. We've got Mark Hamill, you know, we've got Billy Dee Williams, but we can't seem to find a Yoda because Frank Oz is not interested in doing it. And I said, oh, impatient is he? And bam, he hired me on the spot.
That's awesome.
So that's somewhere on my long resume.
Oh, you got to be Yoda.
Yes, I was Yoda. And Frank, meantime, has become a great friend over the years. Actually, we never brought up the fact that I did his voice.
Remember how I...
Yes.
Well, this has been a wonderful conversation.
Well, you're great at this, Chris.
Oh, thanks.
How do you know how to ask questions with no... legal pad in front of you?
I don't know. I just talk. I'm a talker.
And you're a great talker.
I'm a talker, and I like talking to nice, interesting, talented people, and so it's easy for me to, I don't know, it's just a conversation. The whole interview thing is, I never want people to feel like, get the light on. Yeah. Okay, now you're being interrogated. In 1973, you did this. Explain. Well, here's my answer.
Well, you know, you emanate a certain little... I guess it's kind of like the chemicals that the aliens emanate in Buckaroo Banzai, if you remember that.
You're wonderful. That's a tremendous compliment.
You are wonderful to talk to. I've always been amazed, like, if you go on a press junket for a movie,
sure,
you have to talk to about 40 different television journalists from across the country, and each of them has about 4 minutes, and that's all they have. So that they can get their stuff and take it back to their local stations.
Same 10 questions.
So it's exactly the same questions, but I just find it so astonishing that some people are so easy to talk to, and you feel so clever and scintillating and delightful, and other people asking the same question verbatim completely shut you down.
I mean, I have to say, I think there's something with the hour format where you can actually get into a conversation.
Uh-huh.
And I think with sort of press junket soundbite culture, it's just like...
It's a killer.
We just need one line, and then, yeah, then you're going to watch Entertainment Tonight, and after, you know, hours of conversation with them, you'll be like, John Lithgow says working on Third Rock is... It's pretty great. And then they cut to something else. You're like, that was it?
Right.
That was what you used?
Yeah.
Yeah, no, it's all soundbite culture.
Very true. Well, this was just delightful.
Oh, thank you so much. Well, how long is the Columnist running
till
for?
Till mid-July.
Okay, great.
So come see it. It's just
I would love to.
It's a wonderful play. That's
I
wonderful.
Would really love to. Yeah, I'll be back in June, and I'll swing in and get
great.
Some tickets.
Cool. Do.
Thank you so much. Good to see you.
Great to see you. Wonderful to talk. We'll do it again.
Thank you. We say something at the end of the podcast, which is we tell people to enjoy their burrito, which uh-huh. means enjoy your present. Like, don't live in the future, in the past. Would you feel too much like a puppet if I asked you to do it as Yoda?
Oh, no. Enjoy your burrito, you must.
Oh, I'm going to cry. Thank you.
That was great, Chris.
That was fantastic.
Now leaving Nerdist.com. Enjoy your burrito.
This episode of the Nerdist Podcast is brought to you by Stamps.com. Go to Stamps.com, click on the radio microphone at the top of the homepage, and type in Nerdist for a $110 bonus offer, including a digital scale and $55 of free postage. That's Stamps.com. Enter the promo code Nerdist.